Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Would like to win that. Anyway, where was I now? 17 minutes past 10 o'clock, Sunday morning, 51552. Dave Fanning till midday. We're with you every Saturday and Sunday, 10 till 12. Larry then takes you through lunchtime. Let's go over something else now, because he is a 69 and he is Alan Rickman, officially in the list of the top 50 sexiest Hollywood stars of all time. Yeah, his best known roles, I suppose, range from the baddie in the first Die Hard, the Sheriff of Nottingham in the Kevin Costner Robin Hood movie, to a starring appearance in all of the Harry Potter movies. He's a former member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and he now stars in and directs A Little Chaos, Kate Winslet co-star. So here, before we talk to Alan himself, Kate Winslet mistakes Alan Rickman, who plays Louis XIV in the Garden of Versailles, for the gardener.
You are a devoted pairman, Master.
I quite like them, not overly.
I think the Master is playing a trick on me.
A trick?
Yes, I do know of your book on pears.
My book on pears? Oh, yes, I have written a book on pears. I believe I said I liked them a lot in my book.
I believe you did. And perennials. You like flowers, Master?
Madame de Barra, I love all flowers passionately. However, I'm banished from using as many as I would like at Versailles by the Master Le Notre. He indulges me in a few small parterres. I'd hope to be able to convert him when we took up residence. However, you're wise to me now, Madame. May we ignore all that and continue as before? Today, I am Monsieur de la Cantinie.
Indeed, and you are.
So, Alan, let's take a look at the movie itself, then. First of all, you're directing yourself. And secondly, it is a movie that I could say it's about landscape gardening of 400 years ago. It's not a great sort of sales pitch, is it?
Well, because it's not really about that. That's just a sort of backdrop, which is highly visual one, you know, there's a lot of texture and detail for people to feast their eyes on, but really it's a story about a man and a woman that could have been written about now.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well then if I say it's a film about 17th century gardening, it's actually a film about a woman with very revolutionary ideas.
Well, revolutionary just by having a job for a start, because yeah. Of course, you know, thank God for the movies, we can make it up. There wouldn't have been a woman with a job at that time, let alone a landscape gardener. You know, they're all there just to be set decoration for Louis XIV.
And you want somebody who is intelligent, and you want somebody who is vulnerable, and you can't go better, really, for that kind of thing to get the two of them across than Ms. Kate Winslet.
Intelligent, vulnerable, strong, hardworking, brave, honest. Yeah, all of those words.
And the character she has to play is strong-willed and a very talented landscape designer. But she gets professionally kind of and romantically entangled with somebody who you might think at first is the complete opposite. But actually, they both have something they have to overcome.
They've both got to discover who they are, and that's what really intrigued me about the writing, which is, I should say, by Alison Deegan, and it was born and bred here in Ireland, in our house in Wicklow. It's about, I suppose in some ways, the masculine side of a woman meeting the feminine side of a man, and both of them aware of that, I guess, and so it becomes a kind of slow negotiation and towards a real and deep love affair, but they both got to discover things about themselves individually before they can actually hand themselves over to that.
Yeah, because like he is kind of brooding in a loveless marriage and she is plagued by remorse, and we get little hints but not fully until later
She's
on.
She's got a memory that's been locked off. She can't remember the details about the death of her daughter.
Yeah, and she's like a traumatic event for her and then a manipulative wife with him.
Yeah.
So in one way, they're both restrained in some way. So is it inevitable that we're going to get what we get? Like, I don't want to give away necessarily too much, because there's one very important thing that happens in the movie at one stage. And I wonder would I be allowed to say this? And it's that, like, the first move physically to each other comes surprisingly not from who I thought it would come, but hey, yes, I can get away and say that. I was surprised by that in some ways. And is that okay that I was?
Like,
I
mean, why not? I think it's good for men to be surprised by a story about a relationship between men and women that's been written by a woman, not as a kind of flag-waving piece of feminism, but just as an honest relationship that doesn't have any cliches in it about what is it to be a woman, what is it to be a man, what is attraction.
Yeah, right, indeed. So, like, I mean, if you take it that, because it is a period drama, that it is a romantic drama, do you look upon something like that as saying, I better be true to what this was, to what the Sun King was 400 years ago? Or do you put in modern, sort of, not sensibilities, but a certain amount, like, I'm not saying you pander to a Facebook generation, I'm not going that far, or put in some little wisecrack things like something you might get out of a Pixar movie, but I'm just saying there are one or two little bits in it that probably weren't 400 years ago.
It's full of, you know, whenever I talk about this film, I say this film is completely historically inaccurate.
First, right, okay, the way I'm beating around this bush, sorry.
First of all, Lenotre, who was a real person, you know, Sabine couldn't have been, Lenotre was. He did design the gardens at Versailles, but at the time of our story, he was 70. So we've sliced 35 years off his age for a start. Right. At the time of the story, Louis XIV would have been in a bath chair being wheeled onto that dance floor at the end of the film. He certainly wouldn't have been standing up, shaking a leg. But I like that about the movies. It's not pretending to be a documentary or a biopic. It's taken a story and twisted its neck, if you like, to make you, I hope, kind of forget about the period after a while.
Do you find in some ways that a lot of movies that might depict that kind of time are often a bit spoofy or a bit false in the way people speak and maybe are much more made up than we ever realise?
Well, not if they're written by great writers. See, I had the great luxury of years ago doing Sense and Sensibility that Emma Thompson did, and that was almost like she'd kind of inhaled Jane Austen and then exhaled it in a slightly different form so that we could all speak it. You still felt that you were in that world. And I think what Alison Deegan has done brilliantly is to give us modern sensibilities and modern language in this film, but just lifted it a little bit. Maybe it's something to do with her being Irish and her sentence structure. It's certainly not English.
Right. Like when you take on the classics, like the real ones that people know or the ones that people have read maybe in college or maybe have seen other productions of, whatever, do you kind of like to pull a little bit of the rug out of the expectations that people might have and yet stay as true as be damned to what is actually there on the page?
I think what makes a play great is the fact that you never discover it, and it's always got to be seen through the times we live in. That's what, you know, I was here not long ago doing an Ibsen play. And
at the Gaiety, yeah.
At the Abbey.
Excuse me.
And what was remarkable about that was we were doing it, 3 years ago, and it was about a nightmare of banking. It could have been written yesterday. That's why nobody ever gets to the bottom of Shakespeare, because it's the themes and what they're about are completely about human beings here and now.
When you talk Shakespeare, when you talk a lot of the stuff that you might have done in the early days, you were a calligraphy and watercolour painting person. You did a bit of drama, then Chelsea College of Art and Design, then Royal College of Art. You really wanted to be a graphic designer or something along those lines, didn't you?
Well, I was a graphic designer, but, you know, as you realise, life is it's an awful lot to do with hindsight, where you don't know quite what you're doing or why at the time, but eventually you work it out. And here I am sitting now talking to you about a film I've directed. I wouldn't have directed that film or any film or work I've directed in the theatre without my art school background meeting my training as an actor.
And when you say you were a graphic designer, that was for the Notting Hill Herald. That was a good left-wing thing, wasn't it?
It was, and it was free. And it in those days, of course, there were no computers, so it was also through the night with letraset, if anybody knows what that is. It's like one letter at a time, rubbing it down onto bits of paper.
And do you think, from your parents' point of view, or certainly from your point of view, well, your dad wasn't around by that stage, but do you think that there was better prospects for the future in something to do with graphic design than that bloody acting nonsense?
I've honestly never thought about life like that, and thank God I had a family that just said, oh, well, whatever makes you happy. I think you have to, it's a bit like going to a restaurant, you know, you look at a menu and your stomach chooses one thing and your head chooses another, and there's got to be some sort of negotiation between the two. And it's a bit like that with career choices, I think. instinct has to come into it.
One of the career choices was kind of made for you once you did the first one, which was the Harry Potter, and you've done all 8 Harry Potters. Mm. The audience that might go and see you now, maybe on stage or something like that, do you find that there might be a lot of first-timers, a lot of young people, a lot of people of a certain age who have grown up through Harry Potter and don't know anything about the theatre, but hey, your man's in it, Snape, I'm going to go and see this.
Definitely, and I did a play on Broadway about 3 years ago, and I would go out to the stage door afterwards, and there'd be a couple of hundred young people, and actually it's thrilling to hear them not talking about whatever movies they've seen me in, but actually saying, I've never been to a play before, that was fantastic.
But it is nice also to be for people to talk about you being in movies as well. I mean, like, you know, you're not going to go down heavy now on Hans Gruber or anything, are you?
I can hardly remember it. It's
well, it was in you the should. Dim it's on TV every second
I
week.
Know, that's true. Well, I don't watch it. No, I'm very proud of that film. It's that rare thing, an action movie that had a script.
Right.
You know, they kind of forgot that lately.
So is that always the thing? I mean, regardless of money, we leave that one out for the moment, but the director, the location, the timing, everything else, is it really always down to the script?
Yeah, because any actor is really only as good as their script, unless they're, you know, muscle-bound or something, and, you know what your job is there. But, you know, I mean, it's all about... I only know that my imagination will just not kick into gear unless I read something that creates images, and then I kind of just hang on to its coattails and do what a good piece of writing tells me to do.
But like those, like the character Hans Gruber with Die Hard or with the Sheriff of Nottingham and all the rest of it, they're ones that people know an awful lot about and have loved down through the years. The Harry Potter, the same thing again. Is there a question often with you, as with, say, a Clint Eastwood who might do something in terms of, I'll make the big movie here and make the money thing, but I'll make the Bird kind of movie that he makes, or the smaller movies here. Do you like to do that, or do you see a differentiation? Do you make a differentiation between the two?
Not really.
It's all acting.
I've done a lot of movies that have disappeared without trace that I'm very proud of. Little films that, you know, it's very hard for the little films to get distribution. It's not, you know, you've got to be realistic about this these days. Everybody's making superhero films because people are more and more sitting at home and watching their box sets. And the good news is that there's wonderful writers writing for television. But I think there's a real crisis looming about cinema, and I'm certainly not, I don't think, going to be in any comic book superhero films, but I'm still going to fight to try to get little independent movies out there that aren't riding on a cliche.
Just as a matter of interest, one thing about that happens in the movie, and is this historically correct? If the women want to talk about people who've been lost in their lives, who have died, and kids, and etc., were they not allowed to talk about that kind of thing in court?
Well, I think in terms of... You've got to remember, with Louis XIV, he would sit and have his dinner, and there would be... Well, certainly the women wouldn't be around, for a start. There would be, like, 40 lords standing there watching him eat, hoping for a crumb of conversation to be thrown at them. When I went to Versailles, we went into his bedroom, and there was a gold fence in front of his bed. I said, "What's that for? To keep the tourists back?" And the guy, the Louis expert, said, "No, no, no." When Louis went to sleep at night, he would have his big sleep until like 2 a.m., and 60 people would be watching him sleep. Then he'd wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, send 40 of them away. So conversation about dead children or dead husbands wasn't in it. What he's trying to do, of course, is stop people plotting against him. I mean, the issues were big, and meanwhile, he's building Versailles.
Right, yeah. And by the way, can I just say also, the last shot in the movie, I'm not going to say what it is, but the last shot in the movie, had you always got that in mind in terms of this, you know, just... I can't say anything about it, but it's brilliant.
We did have that in mind, and it's testament to the people that made it work.
Yeah, and by God, it worked completely. Just a few other bits and pieces of stuff. Like, I mean, one of the roles that I saw you in that I absolutely loved is a role That's a comedy. Now, we're talking here to Alan Rickman. A lot of people think, well, I don't necessarily know Alan Rickman from... I know him from Bad Guys of Sheriff of Nottingham in the Robin Hood movie, or I know him, you know, from The Die Hard or whatever. But, like, it's Galaxy Quest. Mm. I loved Galaxy Quest.
So do a lot of people, yeah. And so do the people who made it.
Right, yeah, but, like, was there any way at all that you might have been taking the piss out of yourself in some ways with that? In terms of a perceived idea of who you might have been in real life?
No,
hold on, that's what I mean. I don't mean the character, because that's what the... I'm talking about Alan Rickman. No,
not really. Just sort of generic actors who find themselves trapped in a TV show, which he is with his rubber head on, but wishing he was playing Richard III.
Well, that's what I mean—the Shakespearean kind of like I should be an actor.
Actors are just one of the few professions that don't mind taking the piss out of themselves. You know, we don't take ourselves that seriously.
In the early days, when you were starting off, you were a dresser for Nigel Hawthorne, but you were there with Sir Ralph, the great Ralph Richardson.
I was.
How was that?
Well, unforgettable, really. It's the stuff of kind of novels about being an actor.
It really is. My Week with Marilyn kind of thing.
I was standing in the wings exactly. Watching Sir Ralph Richardson every night and, you know, again, a bit like Louis XIV, really hoping for a crumb of conversation to be thrown your way. What did I learn? I learned a kind of huge lesson, which is that if you're going to measure some sort of great acting, what it was with him was I never knew quite what he was going to say next, and I never knew quite where it was coming from, because he was so physically and mentally in the moment with his fellow actors that it wasn't about performing, it was just about inhabiting and listening and the richness of his imagination.
So it wasn't just that he was Ralph Richardson 24 hours a day as such. Like you couldn't take
well,
the dancer from the
dance. Well, I think he was pretty eccentric, maybe that's another word for interesting. You know, he did arrive on his motorbike, and he did hire a coach in one show and take everybody down to the seaside after the show for fish and chips. And
go on, Ralph.
He's a great man and a great, great actor.
Yeah. Like, you've played with a lot of people who are real people from real life, and some of the people, like, they wouldn't necessarily know too much about Hilly Crystal from the CBGBs. They wouldn't. He's not that well known except to rock people, etc. And I presume you probably didn't know too much.
I've got a clue. No, I'd never been to CBGB. I was certainly in New York while it was still there. Now it's a men's clothes shop, but... the word punk didn't really hold any interest for me, but when I did the film, of course you find out that it included David Byrne and Talking Heads and Debbie Harry and Patti Smith and all those people, so it was my loss really not to go down there.
And in the 70s, while you were doing all this stuff in terms of the graphic design and while you were maybe going to college and doing whatever, was music important to you? Was like the David Bowie kind of scenes and all that kind of stuff happening?
It was more about the Beatles to me.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a very good answer. I'll certainly take that. Two other people that you played that are real characters. Very recently, you played Ronald Reagan in The Butler. The Ronald Reagan, like, what do you do when you do Ronald Reagan? Do you just try and find one or two bits and pieces? Or, like, for instance, he was very able to hold an audience. He also knew how to hold an audience away from who he was. And he therefore had time to think of his next question kind of thing, get his thoughts together. He was kind of an actor-y on the set, kind of live kind of person. Did you get it? Did you go on that level at all?
Well, I did a lot of homework, and I had some, thank God, some friends who gave me a tape of him that was very unofficially recorded, so I got a sense of the real man. And I read his daughter's book. That was very valuable. Little clues are very useful. Like she said, I could always hear my mother coming into the room. I could never hear my father. And when he came to the room, he used to look at me as if for the first few seconds he was trying to figure out who I was. That helps you to play somebody who's aware of a certain performance they're having to give all the time. And true or not, I don't know, but I had a feeling that he was ill before he left office.
Right.
So, and I watched a tape where he was trying to remember the punchline to a joke. And the thing that I've discovered, well, it would be a rule of acting, really, having played De Valera and Reagan and Rasputin and now Louis XIV, is you can do the homework, but then you mustn't judge the character. You can't really have an opinion about them. You just have to play them.
And in playing Ronald Reagan, because a lot of people wouldn't think they know who he is or what he is, and have lived through the 80s with him, etc., and even as an actor before that. And then I mentioned Hilly Crystal in terms of CBGBs, who people wouldn't necessarily know, so there's not an onus, as much of an onus, possibly. De Valera would be the same thing, because your average person who went to see the Michael Collins movie had no idea really who Eamon De Valera was and was not expecting you to be anything other than whatever. So did you get directed by, like, would Neil Jordan have told you what he might have wanted? No, this is what De Valera would have done. Or again, did you read stuff and check up stuff?
Well, I'm sure Neil won't mind me saying that when we had a read-through after we talked about me doing it, and then we all gathered together to read it, and he said, "So, do you hate him yet?" And I thought that made me immediately put on boxing gloves in defense of him. So I thought, I can't play it from that point of view. I mean, clearly, Neil's agenda is the same as a lot of people's, but mine couldn't be.
No, indeed. Okay. So next up for you then is going to be what exactly? Because, Alan, like, you know, this is now the second movie you've directed. It's only the second in 20 years, by the way. And you directed yourself in this movie. So where do you go from here, or do you think? Or is it back to whatever?
Well, like, you know, there's a lot of actors directing movies at the moment. They don't do it all the time, and then they go back to acting. And in my case, you know, the theatre is always, like, sitting on my shoulder as well. And directing in the theatre, I hope to just continue moving from one to the other. It's probably presenting a moving target as much as anything else.
And is Alice in Wonderland 2? Are you going to be in that?
Done that.
You've done that, yeah, you finished that. Okay, so do you like, by the way, working with directors you've worked with before? You've done that kind of thing with Randall Miller a couple of times. I think you've done it now with, obviously, with, what's his name?
Tim Burton.
Yeah, you've done it with Tim Burton as well. So is it good? Do you get to know each other? Yeah, but do you get to know each other's whatevers and expectations?
Well, I suppose mostly you're kind of relieved that they haven't said never again
with
him.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. As maybe some have done.
Could be. No, I've been very fortunate with the directors I've worked with, some incredible people that I've learnt an immense amount from.
Yeah. Actually, just think of Tim Burton. Now, we mentioned Galaxy Quest as comedy and that. You sang in Sweeney Todd.
There you go.
Yeah, by the way, like, as a singer, like, that's not really who you are, is it, as such? I mean, your mother was a singer, wasn't she?
She was, yeah.
And did she sing opera? Did she sing in front of audiences?
She did, yeah. It was always a slightly frightening thing to me as a child, because she had a very extraordinary voice. And you kind of... I don't know what it was about it, really. It was just you lost recognition of that being your mother, because she suddenly became something completely separate.
Of course, yeah. Oh, and just finally, your dad, he died when you were 8 years of age. Did he ever get to see you as King Grizzlybeard acting by any stretch of the imagination?
I'm trying to remember.
He was seven, by the way.
I was seven. He didn't see that because he was a working man and it was done at infant school, so he was out earning a crust.
Okay, well, listen, Alan Rickman, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a lot.
And good luck with this movie and everything else.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.